We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Mike Reddy, thoughts on the SEC staying with an 8-game schedule in 2024? I think it's a disgrace that they are unwilling to play all of their rivals every year.
I don't know about the rivals part because I don't know enough about the makeup of the eight. So I'm simply saying I literally don't know enough to comment on that. I think it's total chicken you-know-what that they're playing 8 games. I'm so sick of this. Well, we play a tougher conference schedule. No, you don't. The teams in the East definitely don't, no. Right? This whole, oh, we're so much better. Based on what? Oh, NFL draft. Like, look, you guys are constantly having disappointing years recently. Like, there was a time, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, where the SEC was just here and everybody else was way down here. I mean, they were just dominant. It's not the case anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times we got to watch Ole Miss just go get outclassed in a major bowl game by Baylor or, you know, a team like that? You know what I mean? Like, I'm so over this whole, well, we shouldn't have to play anybody out of conference because of this. Now, there are some teams in the SEC that are more than willing to play teams. Georgia did a home and home with Notre Dame, right? They played Clemson a lot over the last 10, 15 years, right? And when Clemson was good, they would play. They've played Boise State back when nobody else outside of Oregon and Washington were willing to play Boise State, right? So I got respect for some of those teams. LSU has had some decent non-conference games. Auburn has been willing to go out to USC and play USC. They've been willing to play some tough teams. They Auburn played Clemson recently.
They go to Penn State this year, don't right. they? Auburn?
Yeah, because then they got beat at home by Penn State last year.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm so over this, but the media allows them to do it. I mean, you're a 16-team league, and you're not even going to play half the teams in your league. What are you a 16-team league for at this point in time? Like, and how are you going to sit there and tell me that? Because here's the thing that drives me nuts. Well, you know, the strength of schedule is, to me, I have a problem with the strength of schedule because the strength of schedule almost kind of like gives you brownie points for being an SEC team.
Yeah.
You know, like I was looking at the strength of schedule on ESPN, on the FPI, and Notre Dame and Texas were the only two non-Big Ten or SEC teams in the top 20.
Wow.
Right? And partly the reason that Texas is in the top 20 is why? Because they're playing at Alabama.
Yeah.
Right. That's what it is. And then, of course, Notre Dame's is different because they play so many Power Five teams. But I just get so tired of this whole, well, you're telling me the strength of schedule before we've played a single game is such that the SEC and the Big Ten are this dominant conferences. Well, you know, you're assuming that to be the case. And that's why I think a lot of people have said the expansion to a 12-team playoff is going to be unfair because the SEC and this, that, and the other. First of all, I don't think the SEC is going to get 6 or 7 teams in there. I think they're going to get 3, the Big Ten's going to get 3, and then there's going to be 6 others. And I think what's going to happen in a lot of those is some of these teams are going to get exposed as you're not quite as good as you actually thought you were, but you're able to sort of get the same matchups year after year after year after year, and you didn't have to go out and play this style of play.
Yeah.
Alabama's a phenomenal program, but like there's been things they've been able to avoid. They've been able to avoid some of the conferences that are maybe doing things that could give them some problems back when those conferences were really good. Like they didn't play a lot of Big 12 teams when the Big 12 was high octane. They did play Oklahoma once in a bowl game. Do you remember what happened in that game? with Trevor Knight at quarterback, Oklahoma worked them in that bowl game. This is in the middle of Alabama being great. This is, I think, the 2013 season,
yeah,
if I remember correctly. So, you know, my whole thing is, Sean, is I just think it's ridiculous and absurd that they're a 16-team league is only playing 8 conference games. And, yeah, and it'd be one thing if you're going to say, hey, look, we're going to only still play 8, but what we're going to do is we're going to get rid of the FCS game in November. Okay, I don't like it, but okay, at least you're doing that.
Right.
But they're not even willing to do that. So that extra – so it's not like that 9th game is, you know, them going to play Notre Dame or Oklahoma or, well, I guess, yeah, Oklahoma being the legal Ohio State or – Indiana, Illinois, Washington, even Washington State.
When does that Bama Notre Dame series start? 27
and 28, I think, 28? Is when it is.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like you're not. Those aren't the games you're keeping that you're adding by not playing a 9th game. It's no, you're doing this so you can play Mercer in Savannah State and Prairie View and Jacksonville State, and, you know, pick a FCS school from the Southeast, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what you're doing. And it's...
How about this? How about making Bama and Georgia actually play during the regular season? How about that?
Right.
Do that. Instead of setting up your championship game every year.
Right.
Make Bama and Georgia actually play each other.
Yeah.
Michigan and Ohio State play every year.
Ohio State has to play Michigan, Michigan State, Penn State every single year. Every year. And Michigan has to play Ohio State, Penn State, Michigan State. So, yeah, I mean, and it's actually the team that they cater to the most is Georgia. Because Alabama isn't – you can't judge – I don't judge Alabama negatively because they don't have to play Georgia every year because they have to still play LSU and Arkansas and A&M and Ole Miss and Mississippi State, and it's still a tough league. But Georgia for the last 7-8 years, the SEC East has been
The schedule this year?
It's ridiculous. It's not as bad as Michigan's, but it's bad.
I think once they play Ole Miss and Tennessee back-to-back. Like that's like the 9th and 16th of November.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the season.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is their schedule. They open up with 4 straight home games. They play UT Martin, Ball State, South Carolina, and UAB. Then they play at Auburn, then home against Kentucky, at Vanderbilt, bye week, neutral field against Florida, Missouri at home, and then you play at Ole Miss, at Tennessee, at Georgia Tech. So you're talking about Tennessee. You're talking about Georgia doesn't have to play any of the top 3 teams, I would argue. Two of the top 3 teams in the – no, actually, yeah. The top 3 teams in the West, they don't have to play, like traditionally speaking. They don't have to play Alabama. They don't have to play LSU. And they don't have to play Texas A&M. They don't have to play Arkansas. Like, it is – actually, I'm curious about this. How often did Georgia and LSU play in the regular season? Because I know Alabama and Georgia don't play very much.
Now, Georgia and LSU have had some really good games where they have played.
So the last time they played in the regular season was 2018. The last time they played, and that was LSU whooped them in that game. Before that, the last time they played in the regular season was 2013, and then before that, they didn't play. So since Brian Kelly was hired as the head coach at Notre Dame in 2010, Georgia and LSU have played each other twice in the regular season.
Hmm.
Twice. And I'm gonna look here real quick because I think Georgia has not played Alabama, but a couple times either in that stretch. Let me go to their Alabama regular season matchups as well. So Georgia and Alabama since 2010 have played in the regular season twice, 2015 and 2020. Actually, before the 2015 game, the last time they played in the regular season was 2008. That's intentional. That's absolutely intentional. So since Brian Kelly was hired as the head football coach in Notre Dame in 2010, 13 seasons have passed. LSU and Alabama have played. Georgia has played Alabama and to LSU a grand total of what, 4 times in the regular season. So, you know, yeah, I can't stand it. But it's hard for me with some of these other teams. Like, how do you as the Big Ten make that argument when you look at Michigan's non-conference? I mean, that's as bad, in my opinion. So there was something I saw yesterday too, Sean. I'm going to find this tweet. I think it was, I don't remember who it was, but I think I might have liked it. Let me see if I did. I hope, yes, here it is. This is a tweet from a guy that covers Iowa football for The Athletic. This is the teams in each conference that are playing 10 or more Power 5 opponents in 2003. So teams that in your 12 games, you're playing 10 or more Power 5 teams. The ACC, which in this instance, he included Notre Dame, 10 out of 15. The Big Ten is 13 out of 14. The Big 12 is 11 out of 14. The Pac-12 is 10 out of 12. The SEC is 2 out of 14.
Oh, yeah. Boy.
Yep.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/BlueWire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.
Anyway. Look.
As long as the way I see it, if Michigan and Ohio State have to play every year, then gosh darn it, Alabama and Georgia should be playing every year.
Yeah. I'll somewhat give Bama a pass. My issue is more with Georgia, because Alabama does play Tennessee every year in a crossover every single year.
Facts. And LSU.
Well, but they're in the same division. I'm talking about in the crossover.
In the crossover. But I'm just saying that's a tough game. That's a tough game.
Most of my life, Tennessee was a tough game. It was a good team. Yeah. Georgia's the one I have the bigger issue with. That they don't have like a common – I mean, they've got in-state, like in-division rivals, Florida, Tennessee, but so does Alabama with LSU and all those other teams. The fact that they don't have a – like you said, okay, so we don't make them play the same team every year – but they need to play like one of Alabama, LSU, A&M every year, something like that. Like, to me, that's something that they should do. Yeah. But you know, we don't see that happen. We see them get Mississippi State a lot.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. But yeah, I don't fault Georgia for this, because Georgia on their own has shown a willingness to schedule well out of conference. I mean, they play Georgia Tech every year. They've scheduled home and homes at Notre Dame. They schedule home and homes at Clemson. It's not Georgia that I find it annoying. It's the SEC. and the way that they do the schedule.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's – and I'll be willing to bet you $20 if you could get Kirby Smart on a sort of a back channel. Well, I don't know if Kirby Smart would feel this way. But, yeah, you might. I think that he would even say that I don't know that that's necessarily good for us. It may be different now that they've won two titles, and he's just like, hey, look, let's just get back to the playoff. But I bet you he would have, early in his career especially, would have said, hey, we need those kind of tests to get us ready. I'd bet you Nick Saban would be more willing to schedule tougher out of conference if he didn't have to play LSU and Arkansas and A&M and Ole Miss every year. I'd bet you he would change his out of conference schedule. I'm not saying I like the way he schedules out of conference, but I'm saying I think he would be more willing to change it if they didn't have to have that gauntlet in the West every year.
They're competitors. If you're a competitor, you want to play against good teams. So I agree with you.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
All right, let's get down to some other questions here. We'll mix it up here a little bit. Here's one from Stevie Wonder.
Stevie, thoughts on Tommy Eich as a player now? Indy never pushed for him. He stated this. Indy's class that year was Aceta, JD, Jack, and Maris.
Look, I'd have had no problem with them taking Tommy Eichenberg back then. No problem. I liked Tommy coming out. I didn't think he was going to be an all Big Ten linebacker like he's become. He was a good player. I'd have taken him. What I don't like to do, Sean, is I don't like to do hindsight 2020 stuff when I didn't have that opinion then. Like, I'll gladly hammer Notre Dame for stuff that I told you this is what I thought, and you should have taken this kid, and it turned out to be accurate.
Yeah.
What I will never do is go back and hammer them for kids I also didn't think were good. You know, so like when they passed on George Karloftis, I've never hammered Notre Dame for that because I didn't have a problem with them passing on George Karloftis. I didn't think he was going to become what he became. So I'm not going to crush Notre Dame for a bad evaluation when I made a bad evaluation, you know. And same thing at linebacker. I loved Jack Lamb as a player. Loved Jack Lamb. Now, first of all, actually, he's talking about Jack Kaiser. So I would say going back – that I probably would have taken Tommy Eichenberg over JD Bertrand. I would have. I would coming out of high school, I would have. Jack Kaiser's a different player. I actually liked Jack Kaiser a lot. I'm actually going to try to pull up my rankings right now of how I had that class ranked, just so I can kind of refresh my memory. But I would have taken – Osita was always a high upside guy. I had some issues with Osita as a player. He was very raw. I'm not super surprised he hasn't really panned out at Notre Dame. I think he was more talent than he was necessarily a great talent. I'll see if I can find these classes. Where are they? I got all these files and stuff with all these rankings from players, and I'm trying to find what my old rankings were. So that would be the 19 class. So Maris was my highest ranked linebacker in that class. And so, I mean, I didn't even have Osita in the top 10 of that class. So I would have been fine. JD was my lowest ranked guy of that class. So I'd have been fine looking back at my grades then if they would have taken Tommy Eichenberg over JD Bertrand then. But, you know, Maris Lufau, I love that kid's potential, dude. I loved Maris's potential coming out, Sean.
You know, one of the things that I say all the time, as much as we can sit here and grade these young men and talk about upside, there are certain traits of these young men that you can't put a score on it. It's just, there was something about Tommy Eichenberg that we couldn't score, that we didn't know was on the inside of him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, ultimately, when you get there, you're the best of the best around the country. These young men decide their fates. They decide how much work they're going to put in and the type of player they're going to be. And that's something that's outside of our control, whether it's fans or evaluators. And Tommy Eichenberg is just one of those kids. Mm-hmm. So where we can sit here and say, you know what, I don't really have him, you know, he didn't check out the way he's played it out at Ohio State. But tip it, man. Tip my cap to the kid because he has become an absolute great linebacker at Ohio State, and he's going to play on the next level. I didn't exactly see that When I was looking at his high school film, but man, kudos to the young man. That's
I
the beauty him, Sean, of college football.
I liked him. Like I said, I take him over JD. I didn't see a guy that was going to be an all Big Ten linebacker. I didn't see that. So I'm not going to sit there and crush it around. Like, how could you pass on Liam's younger brother? And I knew then that he was going to be great. I didn't know he was going to be this good back then. So I'm not going to hammer him for it. But I think Tommy's turning. He's smart. He's a good athlete too. I mean, that's the thing is like, he's not just winning with smarts and toughness. He's also pretty good athlete. And that's where I thought he was lacking a little bit. I just didn't see that explosiveness. So kudos to him for putting in the work and becoming that kind of player. But I would have definitely taken him. Also partly because I thought Liam was a heck of a player, and I like when brothers, you know, get to go to the same school, right?
John Leahy, thank you for the question. On three report, Caleb Beasley has locked in an official visit for the Ohio State game. This seems to go against ND policy. Is this Beasley hoping for more NIL money or is a decommitment coming?
First of all, that visit is well over 2 months away. We have all of June, all of July, all of August, and then most of September. So almost 4 months away from happening. So I'm just going to give you four words, man. Let it play out. And that's all I'm going to say on that one. He knows the policy. The policy isn't going to change. So we'll see. Just let it play out. And I wanted to bring this up, even though I'm not technically answering it, but I know that a lot of people thought it. So I'll just say, like I said, just let it play out. And then we'll see. If he makes it on campus in September, then we'll have our answer. But remember the kid from Texas last year, the cornerback, Calvin Simpson Hunt, scheduled an official visit to Notre Dame.
Uh-huh.
And it got canceled last minute because he was unwilling to decommit. And they said, we're not bringing you up if you're not willing to decommit. So, and he wasn't willing to decommit until he knew where he was going to go. And Notre Dame doesn't do that. So just let it play out. Let it play out. All right. Here's a funny one. Rob Osgood says, for Brian, a quick Scott Satterfield note. He was my quarterback in high school, Hillsboro Orange. Let's just say I was a part of a few Ole blocks as an off O-line tackle. That's awesome.
Rob, that's bogus, that does Rob.
Not shock me from that's, everything that's I've bogus, ever heard Rob. About Scott Satterfield. It does not shock me at all.
Oh, man.
At all. I just find him and Eli Drinkwitz were probably two guys that I just would have wanted to slap in the face if we played high school ball together. They just rubbed me the wrong way. Really rubbed me the wrong way. And I like Satterfield coming out of App State. I thought he did a really nice job. His team's played well. I just never really heard him talk. And then you listen to him talk at Louisville and you're like, is this guy literally talking down his team and like blaming everyone else for like why things are not going good? You're at Louisville, dude. You know what I mean? Like if you can't get recruits at Louisville, that's a you problem.
That's a you problem. Man.
So it's that dude. Oh, goodness.
Niles Morgan, Drew Tranquil, Tavon Coney, Maris Leofau, Jay Nosberry, and Jared Grace. What's your ideal combination in a traditional 4-3? And who would be your ideal defensive tackle tandem in front of them from the past 15 years?
Of that group, so what's your ideal 4-3 defense?
Can I just throw this caveat out there before I have heard from several people that played for Notre Dame at the same time.
I know what you're going to say. Grace. Yep.
They said Jared Grace before the injuries.
Yep.
Was a dude.
Yep.
He was a dude. So.
Well, you stole my answer.
Just keep that in mind because I thought you might go that direction.
You stole my answer. If I could get a healthy Jared Grace pre-injury, he's my Mike. Drew Tranquil's my Will. And Jay Nosberry's my Rover. Because I think he's prime. Now, you could also say I put Drew at Rover because he played it.
He played it.
And then put Tavon at Will. I could live with that too. If I can't get pre-injury Jarrett Grace, then I'm putting Tavon at Mike. And him and Niles would rotate there. And then I'd have Drew at Will, and I'd have really a three-man rotation there. Would be my deal inside. My ideal defensive tackle tandem from the past 15 years. So basically let's say the Brian Kelly tenure, my ideal tackle tandem is pretty easy to go with. I'm going to keep Sean Stephon to it as an end for the purpose of this conversation.
Okay.
It's Lewis Nix at nose tackle and Sheldon Day, 2015 version of Sheldon Day at three technique. That is a filthy defensive line, right? Interior defensive line right there.
So you would take that version of Shell over final year Jerry Tillery?
100%.
Jerry Tillery in his last year, though.
I thought Jerry Tillery had half of a good season in 2015 or 2018. I thought Jerry was good early. I thought he disappeared second half of the year.
Okay.
And his numbers backed that up. I mean, he had, let's see here, 7.5 tackles for loss through the first five games. He had 3 in the last 8 games. Same thing with sacks. He had 7 sacks in the first 5 games. He had 2 against Michigan, 1 against Ball State, 4 against Stanford. He had 1 the rest of the year. So if I could say first half of the season, sure. But the other thing, too, is I like a 3 technique that's disruptive against the run game even more than I like when they can rush the quarterback. And Jerry had 10.5 tackles for loss, but he had like 8 sacks. Most of those were pass game production. Sheldon senior year, Sheldon had 15.5 tackles for loss in 2015, but it only had 4 sacks. I mean, that was all. And Sean, what I love about watching that team, I would love for you guys, this is a lucky lefty conversation to have. I want to know if I'm right on this. I would love for you guys to get Sheldon on your show and say, hey man, did you just freelance sometimes? Cause there'd be times in games where Sheldon would be doing something different than what everybody else was doing. And he'd just shoot in the backfield, make a play. Because I really felt like, because Sheldon was a really smart football player. I really felt like sometimes Sheldon's like, this is a stupid call. And I'm just going to go make a play. Because like everybody be slanting this way. And Sheldon would just go this way and make a tackle for loss. Like I swear he freelanced and just said, oh, this is a stupid call. I'm going to make a play right here. I could be wrong. I don't know that for a fact. But that's just how I felt watching him play. Is that sometimes Sheldon would just kind of say, I'm going to do this and go make a play. Because this call is stupid. So I just, because it was Van Corder's second year. So I could be wrong on that, but that's a lucky lefty podcast question for you guys when you get Sheldon on one of these days on your show. So yeah, he would be it.
Other defenders were thinking like Sheldon. Offensive players were thinking like Sheldon. Like,
yeah.
He wasn't alone.
Yeah. I just think so Sheldon's one of the ones that had the courage to say, I'm just going to go do this here. Like one of them was against Temple. He had a big stop against Temple. And if you go back and watch that play, you're like, he wasn't doing what everybody else was doing. Like yeah. he was doing yeah. his own thing.
Yeah.
But it worked. It worked. And he was awesome that year in 2015. Not having him healthy against Ohio State really hurt them in that game. Because remember, he hurt his foot. They were talking about he might not even play in that game. I think he played, but he was very hobbled. He was clearly not 100%. But yeah, he was so good that year. And then you give me Big Lou at nose guard. Whoever my inside linebackers are, they're going to be running free. They're going to be running free. There's no doubt about that. Got another one from Indy Estimate Trucking, Sean.
Which of these players did you expect to have a better Indy career, and which was the most productive in your opinion? Cole Luke, Low Wood, Devin Stutsfield, Niles Morgan, or Aisha?
I think he meant
Ishaq.
Yeah.
Williams. I'm like, Aisha.
Yeah. Are we talking women's basketball here or something like that? Well, the most productive, in my opinion, of that group was probably Cole Luke. Him and Niles were the two most productive by far of everybody else. I mean, Niles was a two-year starter, led the team in tackles 1 year, I believe. Cole Luke had the brilliant 2014 season, and even though he never replicated that year, he still played a ton. So those two is where I would be. I'll tell you, the guy that I thought was going to have a much better career is Ishaq. And I still believe that Ishaq would have, had he not got suspended, was on the verge of really breaking out in his last year. I really think that. And because I would have really liked to have seen what he could have done in 2014. And then there was talk that he might be allowed back in 2015. And I think he would have been really good then. But he was a guy that I thought was going to be a lot better than he was. I liked Devin Stunsell too, and he was pretty good as a freshman. He just didn't want to do the work to continue to be good. And that's what kind of hurt him is, you know, and Sean, it kind of goes to what you talked about earlier, is there are certain things you just can't see on film, and you really can't know until you really watch a kid play. But, you know, Devin Stutsfield, to be the player he was as a freshman, then just really not do a whole lot else after that. You know, it's just there's certain things that you just can't see and you can't evaluate when you're watching film. So here's an interesting question from an Ohio State fan, Sean.
Well, what's the loudest you've ever heard Notre Dame Stadium be, both for a whole game and for an individual moment?
So I have talked to people like Tim O'Malley and Lou Somogyi, who have all, Tim Priester, they've all said over the years that the Miami game in 88 and the Michigan game in 88 were the two loudest environments that Notre Dame is. And that was back when they had a 59,000 seat stadium. For me, the two loudest games that I remember were both in, one was in, they were both in 2015, actually. And that was Texas in the opener was rocking. And part of the reason was they were, remember they had just started construction. And the way that things were, it was one of those years where it would funnel actually the noise back in instead of it escaping out. So it kind of amped it up, not intentionally, but amped it up a little bit. And then that USC game was pretty loud too. Clemson this year was in that conversation. Clemson this year was really loud and wild. It was, I mean, just from the moment that that block kick happened, I mean, even before that, though, but like when Cam Hart was making big plays and Benjamin Morrison was making stops, I mean, they just were outfit. Even though, like, we talk about the Clemson or the Notre Dame offense and how physical they were, the Notre Dame defense came out and they were physical that game. I mean, your corners were making big hits. Remember when the tight end tried to run over Benjamin Morrison and he just took it and took him down? It was like, hey, you can run me over. You're 240 pounds, but you're going down and we're getting the ball back.
Yeah, I love Marcus Freeman's comment to Benjamin Morrison when he came to the sideline. Yeah. Like, hey, you need to get low, bro. Yeah. Just get low.
But he took it, right? He was like, I'm coming at you. Yeah. Cam Hart was great in the first quarter of that game. I mean, he was coming up, blowing up runs, forcing them to hold him. And then once the block kick happened, it was just like, I remember when Drew Pine scored that little quarterback keep.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could feel the stadium rocking, and you can't often feel that at Notre Dame Stadium in the press box. You really can't. It's not one of those older stadiums where like the press box vibrates whenever the crowd gets excited. It's not like that. You can feel it. That was in the conversation with those two 2015 games for me. Michigan 2018 was pretty loud in the first half. It just didn't stay that way for the whole game. Like when Brandon hit Fink on that bomb, that place was insane. So we're talking about for an individual moment. Yeah. When he threw that post around, Chris Fink outplayed those two Michigan defenders, that Notre Dame Stadium went crazy. It went nuts. Will Fuller's touchdown against Adoree Jackson was about as loud as a moment as I've ever seen. And it was one of those crescendo moments, Sean, because it was quiet in the stadium. You had just watched Cody Kessler go right down the field and score a touchdown.
Yeah.
You had and if you remember in 2015, that was coming off the year that USC had just obliterated Notre Dame at the end of the year. You're like, oh, here we go again. They're going to murder us just like they did last year. And because that was a game they won 49-14, and that was with Sarkisian calling off the dogs at the end of the game. They could have hung a 70 spot on Notre Dame in that game if they wanted to.
Easy.
Like, they really could have. And so they you come out, they go right down the field, and they do a motion, and you see at the snap, you see Fuller go run his post route. It's real quiet. And when Deshaun throws it deep, right? So you see Deshaun, and you just hear this like slow crescendo of like, because then as soon as Deshaun throws it, they all see freaking Fuller just smoke the Dory off the line. Yeah. And so you hear this crescendo, and the moment that Will Fuller caught it, I mean, that place went nuts. I mean, absolutely nuts. So that was another very loud moment. I was actually fortunate enough to be outside for that moment because I was up top on the – this is in the old press box. They used to let me video the games back then so I could watch them, like do my breakdowns, which they stopped doing. But my wife was – Angela was the one doing the video. So I was actually up there checking on her to make sure because there was some issue with it. And so I was actually outside for that one. I mean, the stadium was vibrating when he caught that ball. I mean, it was pretty awesome. So those are some of my individual moments. Sean, how about you? I know you've been to a few games over the years. What are some that stand out for you?
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It got pretty loud at Soldier Field in 2012 when they beat Miami. It was a pretty loud environment. I was there for 2012. Was it not that Stanford game? What Stanford game was I there for? Not 12.
Was it at Stanford or home game?
No, it was a home game.
Was it the 14 game? The 14 game. The touchdown at the end of the game?
Yeah. It was the 14 game. The game was pretty, but most of my games have been via, I can tell you the loudest I ever thought coming through the television, like what it felt like, yo, that is insane. That 2012 Stanford game seemed like an electric atmosphere, especially for the goal line.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like the crowd was into it. It was raining. That seemed like something that would have been very loud. I agree with everyone that said 88, Michigan and Miami. The Miami game felt the energy coming through the TV. It was like, yo, this is incredible. Because you didn't know what you were going to get, right? Because you didn't know Notre Dame was going to come out and physically just impose their will. Again, this is Miami, man. So to see that, an energy that was built, of course, the T-shirt and everything that was surrounding that. But I remember the 93 Florida State game. That had to be one of the loudest moments because I'm sitting there in my college dorm watching this with some friends of mine that were Florida State fans, and I am talking trash the entire time, the entire time. And I'm talking trash. You know how you talk trash, but you have a fondness?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really liked Charlie Ward was playing. Yes. I was watching him play.
Yes.
I loved Charlie Ward.
Kez McCorvey. Yeah, that was a fun. Derek Brooks was a great line. That was a fun team to watch, except that weekend.
Except that weekend.
And I liked Bobby Bowden. I had a lot of respect for Bobby Bowden, too.
Yeah.
Because Florida State was one of those teams that would go play anybody, anywhere, any place, anytime. You know, I mean, they weren't afraid to play people like Steve Spurrier was. I mean, like Florida did. So yeah. Yes,
yeah. It look, let me tell you something. The stadium.
Can I say something? Charlie Ward was ahead of his time.
Oh, absolutely.
Like way ahead of his time. Absolutely. Like Charlie Ward is like what today's quarterbacks are.
Mm-hmm.
Like he was Bryce Young / you know, those type of guys way before those guys were even born. You know, like he was a quarterback from a different era playing in an era in that era, in an era where I don't think like his numbers would have been so much better in a modern offense. And they're pretty good then. But yeah,
I don't know if you've seen his documentary. He has a documentary out.
I didn't see that, no.
Where he talks about his evaluation coming back from the NFL. And his evaluation is pretty much what made him choose basketball.
Yeah.
He wanted to play in the NFL. He would have been a first-round pick right now.
Today? Oh, yes.
Oh, the type of quarterback he was? Absolutely.
Dude, if Christian Ponder's a first-round pick, Charlie Ward's number one overall pick, yes. Because back then it was so much that they were looking for a prototype.
6'3", 220.
Big arms, yeah, in the pocket. Arm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because like the only guys that were doing things in the NFL, running the ball like Charlie was, were like Steve Young was an anomaly. But at that time, I think Steve had just kind of taken over the Niners.
Yeah.
They hadn't won the Super Bowl yet. Nope. And it was like Randall Cunningham and John Elway, and they were unicorns. But teams weren't looking for that. I mean, you didn't watch John Elway say, hey, we need to find the next John Elway, because you knew, like, there isn't one. You know what I mean? You were trying to find the next Dan Marino, the next Phil Sims, the next, you know, 6'4", 6'5", 6'3", as you said. Big arm, pocket, seven-step drop quarterback. That Jim, because there was a lot of running shoots back then, so you want guys quick, get rid of the ball quickly. And Charlie was throwing the ball down the field and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. Yeah, he would be it would be viewed much differently in today's NFL, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Could you imagine what his numbers would have been like? Like, because he would have gone, like, let's just say, probably played for like a Ryan Day or Lincoln Riley in today's era. His numbers would be ridiculous.
Insane.
Wow. Couldn't be Notre Dame though. Couldn't be Notre Dame though. All right, we got a two-parter here from one of our OGs, Notre Dame 2164.
So I'm watching a few Notre Dame games from last year, and it seems to me that we were much better at run blocking on the O-line than pass blocking. Am I seeing it that way because the run blocking is that good, or do we have a problem pass blocking? What do the stats suggest?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think I'm trying to think how to say this correctly.
I think the run blocking got better as the season went on. Yeah,
I think the pass blocking was a mess early because there's always a lot of different reasons why the pass game isn't working, right, protection-wise. And it's not always because your offensive line is not protecting. I think there was communication problems early. Like Ohio State just ran two different inside blitz, like delayed blitzes that Notre Dame just wasn't prepared for and didn't know how to react to. So obviously that was a problem. I mean, that was something, but those weren't things that really hurt them later in the year. For example, I think that when you look at Notre Dame's pass pro last year, I think they ranked like 40th in the nation in sacks allowed. There wasn't a whole lot of difference between them and the top 30 teams. It's 2-3 sacks. A lot of those happened early, when they were still figuring some things out. I also think there were things that happened where the offensive line was – the checks weren't good. The protection checks from the quarterback weren't correct. I think Marcus Freeman has talked about this a little bit last year where, you know, the quarterback's got to set certain things and have an idea. And then a lot of other times there were sacks that happened last year. I can think of 3 or 4 off the top of my head where it's like, that's the quarterback's dude, right? I mean, like, you know what your protection is. We're running a mic protection and we're going to the mic here. The running back is here to hear. If they bring off somebody off the edge here, quarterback, that's on you. You got to have the answer for that. We don't have an account for that guy. Now, it may not be a thing where they're brought more guys that we can block. That's not always what a blitz is, where you just overall bring more guys than we have. But you know that we're going to slide our protection here, so you bring an extra guy off of here. And because teams get tendencies for pass protection as well. And it's your job to say, hey, look, you can't always be a team where if the back is – whatever direction the back is, it tells us where the protection is going. You can't be that way. You know, you've got to be able to mix it up. But sometimes teams get it right and they take a guess and they say, hey, we think there's a greater tendency that when the back is here and a 3-by-1, that they're running the slide here or they're running a mic protection there or whatever the case may be. If there's no tight end, they're going to run the slide. If there is a tight end, they may run a mic protection, whatever the case may be. And so then you bring pressures off of where you know that they don't have the numbers to account for it. Well, it's up to the quarterback to know who we can't block. And then when that guy comes, you know you've got to get the ball out somewhere. And there were times where that didn't happen either. So I didn't think either group was very good early. I will say that I think the run game got going sooner than the pass game, but I think the pass protection aspect of it got better as the season went on and was good. I think some of the issues that happened later in the year when it comes to some protection breakdowns were more about the quarterbacks than they were about.
And I think, like you said, second half of Navy is a perfect example.
Right.
Like Navy just made the decision, we're going to bring more than they have.
Yep.
And we don't think the quarterback can see it pre-snap and figure it out and know where to go. That's what it is. We don't think he can do it. And they were right.
Mm-hmm.
They were right. And people were wondering, like, oh, why didn't the – left tackle do this, or why didn't the right tackle do this? Man, that blitz is 7.
Well, that's not his job. He can't do that, because if he does that, then they run the, you know, and that's part of good scheme from a defense. Correct. Right. That's not his guy. That's not his gap.
In today's modern football, if you blitz one more than they have, then guess what? More than likely you have an athletic quarterback that can make a play, extend the play, and then get something out of it. Yeah. It happens every Saturday, all the time. So, yep. You're right.
Yep. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't plays. Blake Fisher had some inconsistency in pass pro. Mm-hmm. I thought the guards had a little bit of inconsistency in pass pro. But a lot of times it was due to just, like, I thought the running backs were a little inconsistent early. but they were better late in the year. Yeah. A lot of times, I think some of the issues were more quarterback related than they were.
Like Blake Fisher had a bad game against Stanford. He just had a bad game.
Yeah.
It just wasn't his best game. And he had a good season. That Stanford game was just not his best showing.
Definitely not. Definitely not his day. And that's going to be a key for him. I'm going to have an article coming out on him probably tomorrow. I'm going through these player profiles and such, and hit that one for him will be about just the consistency.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to be the key for him.
Brandon Plenser, why do you think the lack of patience in recruiting from the BK era has transferred over to Marcus Freeman's tenure? Is it something to do with Notre Dame as an institution or strategy?
I don't agree with the premise, to be completely honest with you. Brandon, I think your biggest problem with Notre Dame right now is not that. It's not a lack of patience. It's just you have different – I'm not going to say wrong because you could be right. You and Notre Dame have very different evaluations of certain players. I think you're going to look at Teddy Rizak and Bodie Cahoon and say they didn't have patience. And now I know I've had these conversations with people that would be in the know. It's not about that. Teddy Rizak was not a guy they took because they got nervous. They took him because when they were able to see workouts and I mean, you're talking about a kid that they were able to get verified 4.52 time on, that visited campus and measured in at 6'3.5" with 33-inch arms and ran a 4.52 and tests out extremely well. And they say, this kid's got an incredibly high ceiling. We want to get on him before anybody else does. That's not about a lack of patience. That's about an evaluation that you happen to disagree with, which is fine. I'm not saying who's right or wrong. I'm just saying Bodie Cahoon is not a kid that they took because they lacked patience to wait for Kingston or Chris Cole. They love Bodie Cahoon. Again, another kid with a verified 4.5 40 time that's still learning the game of football. They're betting on the ceiling in a year where I don't think that they really love the linebacker class, which I don't either. I just think it's more of an evaluation difference of opinion. Cole Mullins is another example. You're not that high on Cole Mullins. Totally fine. I think Cole Mullins is a dude, and I think he's got a ton of upside, and Notre Dame loves that kid. So we may say, hey, well, why not wait for Malachi Williams? Well, why do you assume that they like him more than Cole Mullins? I don't think that they do. I don't think that they necessarily view certain guys as better that you might think are better, which is, again, Brandon, I'm not coming down on you. So I don't think it's a lack of patience, Brandon. I just think that they're making evaluations that you don't agree with. And we'll find out soon. And Brandon, I do know this enough about you. I know that you would love to be wrong about the ones that you're concerned about. And I feel that way with certain, like Sean Silviano's a kid. I don't get excited about him as others do. I hope they're right. I hope I'm wrong. You know, I do. There's certain kids that they've taken this year. I've said this. I'm not as high on Carson Hobbs as Mike Mickens is, but I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt because he's earned it. He's shown that he knows cornerback evaluation more than I do in his track record. So, and I hope he's right because I love Carson Hobbs as a kid. I mean, he's awesome. I'll say that. I think that, but it's not a, to me, Sean, it's not a lack of patience. It's a lack of – it's a difference of opinion and valuation. Like the Anthony Knapp one, that, again, not a lack of patience, just a difference of opinion and valuation. That's one of those ones where you talk about a coach pounding on the table for a kid. That was Joe Rudolph pounding on the table for Anthony Knapp. Now, he could be right. He could be wrong. We don't know. But it wasn't a patience thing. Aeneas Williams was not a patience thing. That kid came to their camp and dominated. And then the film is incredible. I mean, you know, again, you could talk about level of football, but the film was good. But then he comes to Irish Invasion last year and is outstanding. Receiver, Isaiah Kanyon was not a lack of patience. They see a dude with five-star upside. So do I. They loved Micah Gilbert from the beginning. Not a lack of patience. They just love that kid. So I think the difference here, Brandon, for you is I don't think it's a patience problem. It's just an evaluation problem. If what you say is correct, if what Brandon you think about players is accurate, then the issue will be more about this staff is not good at evaluating players. It won't be so much that they're impatient like Brian Kelly's tenure was, because we've seen that. And if they were impatient, they would have already filled Justin Scott's spot, or they wouldn't have pushed Owen Wafel out and would have made him the three technique and then, you know, given up on Justin Scott. Or, you know, there's certain, like, there's guys in this class now, Sean, they would have given up on Micah Gilbert way earlier than this staff did and taken somebody else.
Yeah.
You know? So that's the thing is, for me, is I don't think they lack patience. I think that there's just some evaluation differences of opinion with the staff compared to what you think, which is, again, please don't take that, Brandon, as me saying you're wrong. You could end up being right. But there's just some difference of opinion from an evaluation standpoint on that one.
Siggy 13, Notre Dame's membership into the AAU is a big deal, in my opinion. They jump schools like NC State, Virginia Tech, who do more research with Fed dollars. Do you think this foretells Notre Dame's move to the Big Ten or just an academic move?
I think this is an academic move. Look, here's why I don't think it's a Big Ten thing. Everybody keeps saying, well, this is, you know, a lot of the Big Ten teams are in there. And that's been one of the issues with Notre Dame in the past, is those are different type of institutions in Notre Dame, far more research oriented. I mean, Michigan State is basically like an agricultural school, more so than like a liberal arts school. I mean, there's an aspect to it, but it's a big agricultural school. Virginia Tech is a little different that way. This is an academic thing. Here's the deal. If Notre Dame wanted to be in the Big Ten before early 90s, like a year ago, like, guys, when they started expansion and they went and got USC and UCLA, does anyone here think that if Notre Dame would have said, hey, yeah, we want to come, that they would have said, no, you have to become an AAU member first? No, they wouldn't have. That's about football. And so you may say, well, hey, Notre Dame is now in the AAU, so they may be more willing to join the Big Ten. I don't think that's the case either. I don't think those two things have anything to do with each other, in my opinion. Now, does that mean Notre Dame's never going to join the Big Ten? Not saying that either. I'm just saying I think this is completely independent of that. That's my opinion on it, and, you know, I just don't see how that's going to have any impact on conference decisions for Notre Dame. It's not sports related at all. This AAU thing is not at all related to athletics. It's purely an academic research type of situation.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.